Okay, welcome everyone. Thanks for coming along to the Ignite main event, being billed by, loosely termed by me and Stu. So my name's Steve Letford, along with a couple of my colleagues. I look after Azure Solutions and cover the country, so that's about 500 managed customers.
I'm Stu Fox, I'm Azure Technical Specialist. I work alongside Steve, covering the same set of customers. I'm supposed to know stuff about Azure, so if anything goes wrong today, my fault. If he says something stupid, his fault.
Stu is the brains of the pair, and the looks and the best dance moves. So here's the agenda. We're going to cover what's on there. And the format is I'm going to talk about a bunch of stuff, and then Stu, the brains, is going to demo it. And so last night, we were walking back from the Ignite, had a couple of beers, and I said, Stu, so all your demos good? He said, yep, all good. And I said, what's your backup? He went, oh, I haven't got one. I said, no screenshots? No. So he's all comfortable this morning, 9 o'clock. He was in the office taking screenshots of all his backups.
I have got a lot of screenshots.
So when we pick these things, Azure itself, the rate of pace is huge. No doubt you're aware that it's phenomenal. It's hard to keep up. Even doing this, we were discussing, hey, is this GA'd? Is this not GA'd? So there's just a quick sample. And this is why we've effectively just picked a few of the things that we think might be of interest to you, the things that we hear most. Okay, so we'll whiz through it. So we're starting from basics. We're looking at a couple of the machines. So we look at our A-series machines. So this is what we started off with. And the way we do these things is we effectively have a big warehouse of these commodity machines. They get tweaked, and they get tweaked kind of down to make sure that the consistency is there. So for example, if you run a web application on an A5 machine in the US, you're pretty much guaranteed that if you take that same application and run it on the same machine in Singapore, then you're going to get the same performance. That's the theory. We have a couple of different sizes. We have basic and standard size machines. And of course, those machines go up. So if you're running high performance, then we go from our A8, A9 up to A11 kind of machines, and we have a bit more memory. So a little bit of a question for you. Obviously, we're going to ask Cortana the question. So we'd have to jump on a plane, head over to the US to make sure we get the answer. And we're going to, this is where we give away things. So if you don't like the session, we're hoping we're going to give you gifts, and you'll be happy with the gifts, and that's how we're going to win you over. Okay, so quick question. So what's the difference between basic and standard VM? Anyone? The guy wants an umbrella? Okay, so guy says SSD. So look, I'll just run through it. So the basic difference between standard, does anyone think availability sets? We kind of hear this a lot. That's good. Okay, so the basic difference is from a basic machine, there's no load balancer. CPU operates slightly less, and there's less IOPS in some of those disks. So that's the basic differences. But given that you stuck up your hand, we'll give you a choice of a prize when you come up at the end. We've got umbrellas, power packs, there's a boat, and there's a Hyundai. if they're gone, then you can have the umbrella.
Steve, I left the boat at home.
Oh, sorry, mate, you're down to the umbrella. Okay, so now we move on to our D-series machines. So they're a bit faster if you want a bit more performance. So you can see there, 60% faster. And what's really key is this local SSD storage. So what that means is there's a local cache that you can use. So we've got a thing called premium storage that Stu's going to talk about later. And so that local cache is needed in order to use that premium storage. So if you ever wanted to use premium storage, they will never run on those A-series machines. You pretty much have to go to the D-series machines, and it will be a D-series or a DS machine. So we move up the scale. So now we get into what we call our G-series, loosely coded the Godzilla series, and because it's a monster. So as you can see, 448 gig of RAM. There's 32 cores in these things. You can attach up to 64 disks. So the people who like these kind of machines are people who are operating our Dynamics series, our Exchange, so CRM, AX, the DataStax guys who are running big Cassandra databases, the MongoDB guys. So they are really enjoying these sizes of machines. So they're rolled out in the US, and the uptake was phenomenal. So there was a bunch of monster applications being run in on these G-series machines. Any of you guys interested? Just curious, from a show of hands. Do you want an umbrella? Okay, so now we move on to effectively our networking. So again, like I said, this is a bit of an overview, and then Stu's going to show you some of this stuff. And so what we're kind of hoping, I suppose, if you're a seasoned veteran on Azure, hopefully you'll get a bit of a snippet of info that you can take away with. And if you're new to it, then you're going to get a whole lot more. So let's have a look at the subnet of the ACLs. So first of all, when you create a virtual machine, the first thing that happens is the fabric controller grabs your request and says, okay, I'm going to create this machine from a bunch of from a template. And so we've written the code. We know exactly what it does. It's very secure, and it creates that machine and sticks it up in Azure. And effectively, all we do is we open up a port, so you can remote into that machine. But that's all. So you get now control of what ports you open, what endpoints do you allow access to the internet, and how do you effectively control the flow of traffic on those machines. So it's very secure until you open it up. So you can subnet those ACLs in between different tiers, so you get lots of control of the traffic, and then you effectively VPN that back into your environment. So you get lots of control. You decide, and I indicated early on, you decide if you're going to open that up or not. So this thing called forced tunneling. If you decide that there's no external access going out from that data center and you want to route all your traffic through your own proxies in your data center, then you can do that. So this is effectively what Microsoft IT do. They don't want anyone in that data center going externally. They route all the traffic back in. They can monitor the traffic. It goes all through their proxies. Obviously, there's a performance implication, so you guys have to decide whether you want to go down that route, but you certainly can. Okay, so now we look into multiple NICs, so built for security. So this is how you can really control your traffic. The subnets are going into different NICs on the box, and you can really monitor exactly what's going on. So now I'm going to switch over to the brains of the organization, and he's going to demonstrate a PHP web application running on top of a MongoDB.
Oh, excellent.
Or maybe some virtual networks.
Maybe some virtual networks, okay. Good, because I was... The ones
PHP skills.
Yeah. So what I'm going to show is a couple of virtual networking stuff. So the first thing, we've got a virtual networking stack in Azure. Probably some of you have been to TechEd before, to Ignite before. See, TechEd, I probably should put dollar in the square jar for that. Been to Ignite before, you will have seen us create virtual networks. I'm not going to take you through that process. It's pretty straightforward, but I'm going to take you through a couple of extra bits and pieces. So first thing, I've got a virtual network up there. You can see on the screen I've got an address space defined, and I've got some subnets. I've got a front subnet and a couple of back subnets. And so I can, I can add more stuff just by clicking the add subnet button, and away I go, and I can make changes, and it's pretty straightforward. Software defined, so it just kind of happens. We'll just get rid of that. So that's kind of nice and easy. So I can kind of muck around with that to my heart's content. So one of the things we often get is, how do I connect my on-premises network through to my Azure virtual network? Well, actually, it's pretty easy. There's an option here which says connect to the local network, and I've actually predefined my local network here, and I've called it Ignite Local Network. And what you'll see here is that it's actually created a little subnet down here called Gateway. And so people say, what's the Gateway subnet? Well, I'm glad you asked, and that's where we put our gateways. It's funny, eh? And what we do is we spin up a couple of gateways in there when you tell us to spin up the gateways. And that gives you an IPsec endpoint, which you can then use to configure your on-prem firewall to connect to. So then you get site-to-site VPN, IPsec, secure. And so basically that's from your site through to Azure. Azure just looks like an extension of your data center. So that's kind of nice and easy. And I can just go save, and it'll go off and make that change for me. Eventually that'll take place. So that's kind of... that's how we get that stuff. You'll see there this thing that says use ExpressRoute. And ExpressRoute is our basic premium offering for connecting through to Azure. So if you want to do high-speed connectivity or have dedicated bandwidth through or a private connection, you go off and you talk to one of the providers that can do it locally. So that's Spark, 2Degrees, Cordia, Vocus, and Vibe. So you've got five providers locally that can deliver us ExpressRoute, and they can deliver you anything from whatever you're willing to pay, pretty much. So that's kind of nice and easy. So once I've got this virtual network, you'll see here the gateway was not created. And this is the last step I've got to do before I can then configure my on-prem side. So I just go create gateway, and I'm either going to do dynamic routing or static routing. I'm going to choose dynamic and go yes. And that'll take about 15 minutes. So while we're doing that, we're just going to stand and...
tell some jokes.
Yeah. Have an uncomfortable silence for a while. That's kind of what I want to talk about there. So the next thing is I want to show network security groups, which I'm in the wrong place for, of course, because I'm looking at virtual machines. So Steve talked about kind of creating ACLs between different subnets. And so we do that with these things called network security groups. And so I've defined three network security groups here. There's backend one, backend two, and my front end. So I'm going to look at this backend one. And I'm in the new Azure portal here now, so you will have seen I've switched over to the switch portals. I've got two running at the moment. And so I've got this network security group, and you can see here, and hopefully you will see that, I've got three rules applied. I've got an RDP rule, which allows any traffic from the internet into my subnet on 3389. I've got a database rule, which allows any traffic from my subnet through to the any traffic from my front-end subnet into my subnet on 1433, so database traffic. I can be more granular here, but I'm slack, so I didn't. And I've also got a deny rule, which basically says anything else coming in from my front-end network, just deny, drop the whole lot. So basically, I'm able to kind of secure my virtual networks in the same way that I would do on-prem with a firewall. So, but that's built into the platform. So that's kind of, and that's basically, you know, like I say, it's a platform feature. You can define it. You can come in the new portal and define it. And you'll see here, it's assigned, and if I wait a second, because it's the wrong one. If I come here and wait a second, you'll see that subnet, that rule is associated with my back-end subnet. So so that rule applies to any machine that sits in that subnet. Those set of rules are going to apply. I can also apply it to a virtual machine specifically, so I could have specific rule sets for virtual machines if I want to. So you've got kind of options around that. So that's network security groups. So that's cool, and customers like that stuff because it helps secure, you know, their environment. But the other thing they say is, hey, Stu, I've got an on-premises firewall that I use, and I use a checkpoint firewall, or I use a FortiGate, you know, and so I use these kind of, you know, I've got a firewall, I've got a process that I manage, and I understand how to get the logs out of, and I understand all that stuff. I want to do that in Azure. And so what we can do in Azure is the same thing. What we've got in Azure is we've got this thing called user-defined routing. And so Steve just talked about that as well. So we can basically say, we can take one of those virtual machines with multiple virtual networks attached, and I can redefine the routes so that the routes, instead of using our default routing table, they get bypassed and they go through whatever device you've defined. So if I run this up, this PowerShell here, unfortunately this stuff's only through PowerShell, you can see I've got three routing tables defined. I've got backend one and two, and I've got front-end routing table. If I take a deeper look inside one of the front-end one, you can see there that I've got my front-end routing table has got routes to the two back-end networks. The next hop type is virtual appliance, and the next hop IP address is 10.0.1.20. So that's my virtual appliance IP. So that's defined a routing table for me, and then I can see if I look at this front subnet, what routing table is applied. And so the routing table that's applied to my front subnet is the front-end routing table. And so any machine sitting in that subnet will inherit that routing. So that's, and again, that all happens at the platform. And then if I want to see on a particular VM what routes are actually being applied, I can use this get Azure Effective Route Table command. And so if we do that, let's wait a second. I like these uncomfortable silences. We can see we've got a bunch of routes applied to that back, and you can see there we've got our back-end routes applied to our device, and that's so that particular VM is inheriting those routes, and you'll see there's a couple of default routes in there. We've overridden those as well. And the last thing is obviously this machine is my firewall machine, so it's actually got multiple NICs, and so I've got different routing tables per NIC because they're attached to different subnets. Kind of makes sense. And so I can do the same thing, and I can look at the other NICs. I'm looking at NIC 2 at the moment. And so it's got a different set of routing tables. And so you'll actually see that I've completely overridden the default route. And so the default route also goes out via the virtual appliance as well. So that back-end network that I'm looking at is completely isolated. So that's virtual networking. Now, if you want to see more about virtual networking, Emil's doing a session on Thursday, M261. So he's doing a deeper dive into Azure virtual networking. So go along and see his session. And so that's the end of the virtual networking demo. Back to...
Enjoy that? Do you know what he's talking about? Okay. So look, I'm standing here, I've got a microphone, I'm older than lots of people in here, so I feel there's an air of responsibility that I need to give some marriage guidance tips. So anyone going to the Rugby World Cup? Well, I am, not boasting. So here's my marriage guidance tip. It can be used across male, female, so tip for everyone. When you're going to the Rugby World Cup on your own with your mates, without the family, don't pack 1 month out. And when the family walk in, start whistling and ask them what they're doing at the weekend and chuck them a ticket to go to Takapuna. Doesn't work. Okay. Marriage guidance tip number one. There's plenty more. Okay, so the Azure Marketplace. This is the growth in the marketplace is phenomenal. You know, this is where you can get templated, certified applications from Microsoft, from third-party vendors, from the open source community. So certified, you know it's going to run. And it's great, obviously, to see our SAP, Oracle, IBM DB2 running up in Azure, certified for running up in Azure. And who would have thought that a few years ago? So, you know, this is the Walmart of solutions. So if there's anything that we are that you're using in Azure, or you get out of the box in Azure that doesn't quite cut it for you, then you have choices of either using prefiguring solutions or extending the solutions that we're already offering. So an example of that would be security. So when I think of the load balancer you get for free, so if you when you stick a virtual machine up in Azure, there's a network access layer, and that network access layer effectively does all your DDoS protection, does all your intrusion detection, so there's IDS, IPS protection, and you get that without any configuration. We're going to protect you. When you spin up a standard machine and you get some load balancing, that's a layer 4 load balancer. But what happens if you want to get down to that application layer? You know, get down deeper into that layer 7 layer. Then you've got some options. And so one of those options, maybe you use a Barracuda firewall. So this is just an example. And so look, it'd be, I suppose, just of interest. It's a bit of lighthearted comedy coming up. Of interest, because an interesting stat is that in terms of cybersecurity threats, what we've noticed is, or what the analysts are telling is that they're getting pretty smart nowadays. And so when there's an intrusion in your environment, generally they've been in your environment for about 8 months, snooping around, using legitimate IT tools. Now, up in Azure, you get some good protection. So one of the thesis behind Azure is effectively what we call assume breach. So what that means is if anyone does get into the environment, I mean, there's obviously the perimeters to keep them out, but if they do get in it, no one has God rights. So they can't do anything while they're in there. They need certain privileges, and it's pretty much locked down. So you've got to ask yourself the same question. Are you doing that in your own environment? And would you get benefit and have a much more secure environment going to Azure? So the other interesting stat for you is when they're in there for 8 months, they've actually stolen existing credentials, your user's credentials. So a bit of a question for another umbrella. No, we've only got two. There's no umbrellas left. There's a power pack. Do you think it'd be easy to get hold of your sysadmin's username and password, your credentials? Anyone think it'd be easy? Anyone think it'd be difficult? So a little bit of comedy. They went out into the US, went to the streets of the US, and tried to find out how difficult it would be to get hold of people's passwords.
Maria.
Maria.
So
Comedy Gold. So obviously,
Steve, they were Americans, though, right?
So they're looking for jobs on Seek now, and they can be your sysadmins. So look, I suppose it's indicative, and if we go back to that assumed breach, if people can get into your environment, then Azure's a far more secure environment, audited, accredited by third-party auditors, et cetera, than you're probably running today. So I'm just going to set the scene now for the next demo before the good looks comes in and does his bit. And so we're talking about this shifting landscape. And so one of the things that's at play here is different clouds. We've released this thing called the Operational Management Suite, and it's to deal with this, or to help with this. And so the environment that you're in now is like developers have this, the choices of developing on different clouds, whether it's Azure, whether it's AWS, whether it's private hosters. And so what do you do across your management suite across these different environments? It gets pretty hard. And so we've developed the operational management suite to help. But one of the things that's really driving it, or one of the things that's causing the complication, is containers. And so rather than just monitoring a virtual machine that's got an application on it, now developers have got access to containers where they can pick up these containers, discrete units of an application, and just plonk it somewhere, and they know pretty much that it's going to run anywhere. And so I'll pass over to my fine-looking friend here, who's just going to demonstrate containers to you. Cool.
So how many of you have heard of Docker? Oh, yeah, quite a few. How many of you are aware that Windows Server is going to be shipping containers in the next release? Quite a few. That's good. That's good awareness. So in Windows Server 2016, we will be shipping a container containerization, or two flavors, in fact, Windows Server containers and Hyper-V containers. Ben Armstrong from the Hyper-V product group, who's kind of building this stuff, he's presenting about this on Friday. He's doing a session M251, so if you want to get to know more about Windows containers, then go and see Ben. There's a couple of things we've done in Azure to support containers. One is just in the marketplace, or if you just want to spin up a Windows Server container and take it for a test drive, we've actually got an image pre-canned there of Windows Server 2016 TP3, which is enabled with containers, and it's got a default image on it as well, so you can basically run that up and have a play with containers and see what it is this thing's all about. The other thing is, of course, there's Docker, so with Ubuntu, we've actually got we've got an image there, Docker on Ubuntu server. So if you spin that up, you'll get a Docker image with Ubuntu running on it. There's images there for you to be able to get started with containers and go quickly. You don't have to muck around by deploying Docker or anything. It's all built for you, and they're in the marketplace. So what I thought I'd do is just quickly show you a couple of things on using Docker against Windows Server. So I've got a command prompt here because it's easier than typing a whole bunch of stuff. I'm using the standard Docker command line tool. So this is compiled for Windows operating system, but it's in the open source. So it's in the Docker open source repository. So the Docker Windows application should work exactly the same as the Linux one. So if I'm running on Windows, I can point this stuff off. And so now I'm pointing at a TP3 image running up there in Azure. So I've got three images up there. You can see I've got, there's two images actually. One is a link to the other. I've got two images there, a Windows Server Core and an Nginx image. And so we can see I've got those images there. The first thing we can do is we can actually run up a Docker image. And so what we're doing here is we're spinning up a new Docker image on that VM called Ignite Demo. You can see it there. And I'm using the Windows Server Core image. And the thing that it's going to give me is a command prompt at the end of that. So in a couple of seconds, I'll get a command prompt. So there we go. I've got a command prompt. And I'm sitting on a Windows Server machine running in Azure. So I'm running inside a Docker container now, a Windows container inside that VM. So that's kind of neat. I can make changes to this. I can, I can install some software, do all my stuff, and then I could use that, and I could capture an image of that. And once I'm finished, I can just, exit out. And I could commit that and save that as an image. I'm not going to, because it does take a little while, and in the interest of time, I won't do that. It takes 5 to 10 minutes, so I won't do that. But what we'll do is we'll look at another one. So you can see there, my image is running. You can see they've still got work to do on text alignment, but name there, Ignite Demo, muttering my command CMD, and so my image is still there running. So I want to connect you back up to it, I could. If I want to kill it, I can kill it. If I want to, if I want to capture an image off that, I can do that as well. So once I've made my changes, I capture it, and it's then created as a new image. So what we've got is that you saw that image there I had before of an Nginx container. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a new Nginx container off that image, and it's already pre-installed the Nginx. And one of the things I'm doing here is I'm mapping port 80 to port 80 on the physical machine. So again, I've got a command line. Super exciting, I know. And so if I go to this URL, which is the URL of my machine, I should get a failure. And that's deliberate. I should get nothing there because the container, inside the container, nothing's actually running yet. The Nginx engine isn't actually started. So you know, it's going to take a while to start. So Nginx, and there we go. And if I go start Nginx, then if I go back here and go refresh, there we go. Voila. So in that container, you know, I'm running that little container, and so any customizations I can make, I can pick up that container layer, give it to another Windows admin, and be assured that it will run. So it's a great way of kind of just giving that true portability, kind of like AppV for servers. And so this runs, like I say, this is running on Windows Server 2016, Technical Preview 3, and it's all good to go. And it's using the same Docker API, so I'm using the same Docker command line tool I would use against the Linux box. And just to kind of prove that, hoping this works, I can actually spin up my Docker image against my Ubuntu machine. And so now I've got the only Linux command line I know. But it looks a bit like Linux. So I'm using the same command line tool against a Linux box running in Azure, running on Ubuntu with Docker. So that's kind of a quick look at Docker and what you can do with it in Azure. So back to the brawn of the outfit.
So demo's going well. We haven't resorted to screenshots yet. So marriage guidance tip number two. So anyone been married longer than 10 years? So again, learning from my mistakes. So when your wife's talking to you and saying, we've been married a long time, things are getting a little bit dull, blah blah blah, and you don't woo me anymore. Don't say woo. Okay. So we're getting to the Azure Resource Manager. So when you're firing up or you're creating these different environments, you wanted to do it in a very templated way. And so we've produced this Azure Resource Manager. So it's a JSON template, and so it's JSON-based, and you can integrate things like role-based access. You get finer control of exactly who can access your systems and through roles. So it's very declarative, and there's a bunch of self-service templates you can put up. So it's called the Azure Resource Manager. Stu's a bit lazy, he likes to call it ARM, and he insisted that I put a picture of mine up there. So, question that normally comes up, well, what about the old API? So it's not so much of a gotcha, it's just a bit of an awareness. So if you're producing the old API, the new Azure Resource Manager and the old API, they're not going to be able to talk to each other. So we are working on what that kind of roadmap in the migration would look like, but just something to be aware of as you get into the Azure Resource Manager, or if you're doing lots of investment in the old API, is what you do moving forward. So over to Stu, who is now going to demonstrate.
Cool. That was quick. So I've kind of flicked between the two portals today, and this is what we call the classic, which I think is a better word than legacy, and this is our new and what we call preview portal. And so at some point in the future, this will become the production portal, and for a while we'll probably run both together. Who knows when that point in the future is? This thing's been in preview for a long time. But one of the things is, hey, we have enabled this concept of Azure Resource Manager. So I guess the first thing to note, and actually a couple of things actually about how it's exposed. So if I go create new compute, and if I just choose Windows Server 2012 R2, you'll actually see here, and I don't know whether you can see that very clearly, so I'll zoom it. You'll see here selected deployment model, classic or resource manager. So classic is basically using the old API, resource manager is using the new API. And so, like Steve says, it will affect something. So if I create it using a classic API, it'll be visible in the old portal, it'll be visible in the new portal. If I create it with a resource manager API, it will tend to only be seen in the new portal. But also it gives you extra capability. Now, I should probably preface this by saying the Azure Resource Manager API is not currently available in Australia, and it will be soon. Without giving dates or anything, it will be soon available in Australia. So at the moment, if I tried to use Resource Manager and create a virtual machine, Australia would actually be blocked out. So one of the things that Resource Manager gives us is the ability to create these templates. So, you know, if I'm building a demo environment, I could come up with some really complicated PowerShell script like this, and that's great, and it's actually really handy, and you can see I've got some pretty secure passwords in there, and but you know, so I go through and I create my virtual machine. You know, I create my virtual network, or I don't create my virtual networks because that's a bit of a bugger of a job in this, but if I want to create, you know, I create my virtual machines, I've got four machines being created there, and this is an imperative model. So I say do this, do that, do this, do that. And if anything breaks, that's cool, but then I can't rerun the script because then I'll get a whole bunch of errors for all the stuff that's already created. So the PowerShell stuff is handy, and it's really good for doing automation, but there are some limitations. So and I know this is an infrastructure as a service overview, but I've just opened up Visual Studio, and even I'm a bit scared because things could really go horribly wrong now. And I don't even know who Jason is, but for some reason he's always resting. So look, he
boom boom,
yeah, it's gold, isn't it? Gold. So what I've got here is a JSON file that's been created using the Azure Resource Manager template in Visual Studio. And so instead of using this imperative model, I'm using a declarative model. And what I'm saying is, Azure, what I'd like you to do is create me a bunch of resources, and you can see them on the left here. A virtual network, a storage account, a web machine, a DB machine, a data, a domain controller machine, and a firewall. I want you to create me those machines. I want some network cards attached to them. I want an external IP address on the website. Go and make it so. And I've just told the Azure Resource Manager, just go and do it for me. I don't care how you kind of do it, and just go and do it. And so it will come back at some point and say, yeah, I've done that, or actually what usually happens in my case is, well, I would have done that if you were a bit better at this. You know, try again. But the cool thing is that you can try again. So when you make a mistake, which I do, you just go redeploy, and you redeploy, and it will take care of making the changes. We'll go, yeah, well, I've already got the domain controller, I've already got the website. Oh, look, he's added another VM, I'll just create the other VM. And so I'm not having to worry about whether I can redeploy this stuff, it's just part of the process. And it's and like I say, I'm authoring this in Visual Studio, and so you can do this in the Visual Studio Community Edition. So if you want to use the free version of Visual Studio to do this, you can. And so there's a few other clever things it does. It's all parameterized, and it's all, you know, done with variables. So I've got a bunch of parameters here, things like what my virtual network's going to be called, where it's going to be, my storage account, all that sort of stuff, what my database tiers are called. And there's a bunch of dependencies I can build into this, you know, so I could have, I could have things like my infrastructure style stuff, so my storage accounts, my networking, sit outside in a separate template. And so I can be pretty flexible about this stuff. And the cool thing is that I can then just deploy it by right-clicking and go deploy, and I can just do ignite resource manager group or whatever it's going to do for me. And so it's going to say, you know, I'm deploying to this resource group in Southeast Asia, and I've got a bunch of parameters in here. And so you can see I've saved my passwords, which is bad. And so it's, you know, there's my stuff. And when I go deploy, it'll just go off and talk to Azure and make that stuff happen for me. And so the cool thing is, then I can then, this could be production, right? I could then pick up that exact same template, change my parameters around, and deploy a dev instance like that without having to kind of change anything. I can wrap this in with things like PowerShell desired state config, so I can actually have the machines configured as they come up. I can do a whole bunch of stuff with this thing. We've got a GitHub repository of a whole bunch of example stuff. So if you kind of get stuck or you need to figure stuff out, there's 40 or 50 things there, and people are adding more. So if you want to go and deploy a Cassandra instance, go and do that. If you want to deploy a load balanced website, do that. If you want to go and deploy new web, you know, web app with a SQL database backend, go and do that. You know, there's a whole bunch of those templates up there. And so you can see that's going on quite nicely, and that will be reflected at some point up in here, and I should be able to see it if I scroll down to resource groups and, what is it called, Ignite Demo or something? Ignite Demo resource groups. There's my resource group, and you'll see in here I've got a bunch of resources that it's provisioning up for me, and so you can see it's actually deploying right now. So that's kind of the nuts and bolts of Azure Resource Manager. And so you can see it's really powerful. And Emil's doing a session on that, which is tomorrow, M391. So if you want to learn more about the Resource Manager stuff, go and see his session. Should be really good. So while I'm here, one of the other capabilities that this gives us, and which is reflected in the new portal, is role-based access. So, you know, if I go back to the old portal, I've basically got two options about role-based access. I'm either a co-admin of the subscription, or I'm not. And so if I'm a co-admin, I've got access to everything in that subscription. So, you know, I could grant access, and then you would have full access to my subscription, deploy anything you like, delete anything you like, and that would be kind of handy. The trouble is that's kind of not how people work. And so in the new portal, we've actually got this little option here which gives us access. And so what I can do is if I've got someone that I work with who I don't really trust to do things right, I can I can give him access so he feels loved, but he's only got reader access. And so we've got all these roles in here, so I can add you can see there's a bunch of roles, so I could set up if Steve was the application owner of this app, I could give Steve the owner access, and he would see all the stuff that's in that resource group and nothing else. So he wouldn't be able to see any of my other storage accounts, any of my other VMs. He'd just be able to see and make changes to the stuff that's contained in that resource group. And so that's kind of a combination of resource manager and role-based access gives us a real bunch of flexibility around how we expose resources to users. So, you know, the example I talked about before, having your infrastructure stuff like your virtual networks and your storage accounts in a kind of infrastructure resource group, you could have people with reader access to it, so they can't actually go and delete your storage accounts, but they can deploy VMs into them and those kinds of things. So resource manager and role-based access add all that flexibility for us. So that's the kind of demo there. So like I say, go and see Emil talk about that on Thursday, M391.
You guys heard Emil talk before? He's the Gandalf of Azure. He's pretty good. So if you get a chance, head over and see him. Okay, so last one. Marriage guidance tip number 3. You guys, this is a silly one, right? So you guys will know this because you're far smarter than I am, far more mature, far more in tune with relationships. So we go away quite a lot, and sometimes for a couple of weeks, and so there'll be pictures on Facebook, you know, having a good time and all this kind of stuff. And sometimes there's an expectation when you come back home that perhaps there may be gifts apologizing for being away and spending all your money. Don't just bring back a fridge magnet. Yes. So that's the last one. So follow these 3 of a magnificent
box of relationship. Chocolates. Box of chocolates helps, Steve?
No, chocolates don't help either. Or kebabs. Okay, so premium storage. And you guys, in show of hands, anyone using premium storage? Great. So when you start running intense applications and that need that you need high IOPS, then you should be considering premium storage. It's a lot easier to set up than just striping and adding lots of disks. It's far easier to get up and running. And so you can start to kind of see the specs there. So you can add up to 64 terabytes of storage, 32 disks. There's 50,000 IOPS. And in fact, if you look in the portal now, there's the GS5. And that's showing 80,000 IOPS. So what we're really saying is it doesn't really matter what kind of application you're running. You can run that in Azure. We have the, in terms of the disk size, we have the CPU that you need, and we certainly have the IOPS that you would need. And so when you get in less than a millisecond read latency, that's pretty phenomenal. Obviously using that cache capability that we talked about. This is again really without even looking at the Godzilla machines, this is something you can attach to your D-series machines. and run things like CRM and AX, et cetera, in SAP. So lots of our SAP customers who are running full production sets of SAP up in Azure were very interested in hearing about the premium storage coming out, and a lot of them switched as soon as they could. So it's just a bit of an overview, and Stu will fire up and show you it working.
Probably should have been getting that prepared before we switched over, shouldn't I?
So
what I'm going to show you is
just
screenshots. That would have been ideal. What I'm going to show you is just a couple of things around getting started with premium storage. So the first thing you need with premium storage is a storage account. And so one thing you'll notice with premium storage is that you can only create premium storage accounts through the new portal. You can't create it through the classic portal. So I will go and I'll show you this. And I got a nice little pop-up there saying that deployment that I just started before has finished. So hooray for getting the template right. So if I go to a storage account and go create, I will eventually get a bunch of options. Cool. And I can give it a name. And I choose my pricing tier. And so if I go view all, you see we've got different options around around Azure storage. We've got our geo-redundant storage, we've got our locally redundant storage, and we've got some zone-redundant stuff. But the one you want to create is a premium storage account. So just create a premium storage account, it becomes a container for sticking all your premium storage stuff in. I'm not going to actually create that because I've already got one, and so I don't need to create another one. So premium storage accounts, first thing you've got to do. Next thing is when you create your VM, you've actually got to create the right VM. So as Steve said, you know, you've got to create these S-series VMs. So I'll just again use my Windows Server image and go create. And you'll see here eventually my pricing tier. And so if I go view all, you'll see at the top here I've got these DS1s all the way up to DS12, maybe DS14s. So you can see I've got these VMs, and so you use either the DS series, and we might even see the GS if we scroll down far enough. So our Gs are not available because we're in the wrong region, but so we've got our GS series as well, and so you'll see that, yeah, like, so you've said this GS5 one here, 80,000 max IOPS, I don't know if you can read that, but so when we create our VM, make sure we choose an S series VM. That will give you access to premium storage. Again, I've already got one, so I don't need to worry about that. I can do that. So that's, you know, so once I've created my VM as a S series VM, I can then attach premium storage to it. And so I've got one here, and I'll just show you quickly how to do that. And it's kind of super easy. I just got to go disks and go attach new. And so you'll see here, instead of, you know, if you've used Azure before and you've used classic storage, you'll see, or standard storage, you'll see, you know, in standard storage, you could say, well, I want it to be, you know, 100 meg or, you know, anything up to a terabyte. In premium storage, we've got three specific sizes. You see them there, 128, 512, and 1023, so just short of a terabyte of disk. And so you choose that, that will affect your pricing model, and then you attach that. If you're looking at pricing, you'll see those referred to in the pricing stuff as P10, P20, and P30, P30 being the terabyte size. And so that's all I've got to do is attach that disk, and then I've got, if I'm attaching a P30, the 1023 there, I'm getting 5,000 IOPS out of that single disk. If I want to get up to that 50,000 IOPS, 10 P30s, striped. You know, if I want to get to 80,000, well, I guess it's 80,000 divided by 5,000, which might be 16 maybe, 16 virtual disks striped. And so, you know, so when you want to get those higher IOPS, stripe. And so striping, you either do, you know, using storage spaces if you're on a modern version of Windows, you know, 2012 or earlier, or you do it using whatever we called it in the previous version of Windows. And in Linux, there's a specific way to stripe in Linux as well. So it doesn't matter what OS you're running, you'll be able to get away to stripe that stuff. And so that's kind of how you do premium storage. Like I say, super easy, but it's just not obvious, especially if you started here and went, well, I wanted to create a new storage account, but I can't find premium storage. So if you miss that kind of vital step of going to the preview portal, you won't get premium storage ever. So just kind of keep that in mind. And Donovan is talking on premium storage tomorrow, M389. So he's doing kind of an hour-long session on storage in general, actually, and kind of how to get the best out of storage in your Azure VMs.
Okay, so in case anyone's unaware, when you put some storage, you store something up in Azure, we store three copies for you. So we write three copies on physically different tin to give you that bit of resilience. You can tick a box, you get that geo-redundant storage, and then we'll copy your data across to the payer. So we keep it within region, so that's important for some of our customers. So you know where your data is, which data center it is, and if you geo-replicate, we only geo-replicate across to that region. So in the case of most of the interest for our customers here, right up to Sydney, tick the geo-replicate box, we copy three copies across to Melbourne. Okay, so we're going to get into, we'll come back into this operational management suite. There's a couple of sessions on OMS, and I suggest you see it. To me, I think it's one of the really exciting things that Microsoft have come out with. And so it talks about, and I talked about it earlier with, we talked about Docker and containers, and this changing landscape shift, and how existing management suites are struggling to manage servers and applications across different clouds, public clouds, and a hybrid cloud. And the number one bit of feedback that we hear from lots of our customers around management suites is they don't want to build infrastructure to manage infrastructure. And so another driver for the OMS, it's cloud-based, you can get up and running in minutes, and it comes with it's effectively a suite of different products. So first of all, one that I think is really interesting is what we call Azure Site Recovery. So Azure Site Recovery now gives you the ability to replicate your changes from your machines up to Azure. So effectively, what that means is you can get rid of a whole data center. So this gets really interesting now when customers are saying, hey, look, I like the cloud, I'm not ready really to put my whole production set up there, but I wouldn't mind stripping some costs out of my business. Now they can have their production data center in New Zealand replicating all the changes in the timeline that you decide every 15 minutes or whatever in terms of the changes hitting up there. And effectively, you've just stripped out a whole data center from your business. So for some customers, that's $1 million that they've just stripped out and they can use Azure. Now, one of the benefits of this is I'm writing changes to machines that are turned off. So I'm not paying for compute. I'm paying for the protection of the machine and I'm paying for that commodity pricing around storage, which is one of the interesting things for customers, why they quite often look at cloud storage. I want to pay commodity pricing for storage at 3 cents a gig. So I write it all up there, I can fire up an automation script now and fire up all those machines, and now my DR is up and running for a failover. So that's pretty compelling. So there's a suite with log analytics, the security, so I can look at intrusion detection, I can look at patch management across all my machines, so if they're running in Azure or AWS, so I can effectively look at my whole environment. One of the other things is Azure Backup. So perhaps I don't want to use the cloud. Perhaps I want to, in terms of ASR, but I do want to use the cloud for this commodity cloud storage pricing. So now I can, instead of backing up to tape, which effectively is really becoming like old school thinking, what I'll do now is effectively use tick box these machines to point to Azure and back up to Azure. And Mr. Fox here is going to demo it soon, but this screenshot is effectively showing you, I can pick my backup frequency, I can pick it exactly when I'm doing my incremental backups, and I can pick retention. So it's very simple to effectively put backups across my environment and use cloud storage.
Hey, Steve, before I switch to the demo,
There's another slide too.
Oh, is there?
One more.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, before I switch to my demo, I'm running VMware in my data center. Surely you can't replicate VMware VMs up to Azure?
Interesting point, Stu. Thank you very much for asking. So we don't care. We don't care whether it's VMware, physical tin, Hyper-V. We can replicate those changes here. So again, that's one of the really exciting things. And it's a really healthy conversation that we're having with customers. Not trying to force them down a Hyper-V route. We're just saying, hey, we can help you around your management of your infrastructure. And this last slide here is just showing you how you'd recover. Obviously, if I'm doing backups, then I need to recover at some stage. And so you can very simply go up there, select your recovery point, and recover back down to your on-premises environment.
Did you add these last night when I said I didn't have any backup plan?
I'll always look after you, Stu, just in case.
You're a good man, Lefford.
And so now we'll flick over to Stu, and he's just going to demonstrate how simple it is to get Azure Backup up and running.
Cool. Right, so as Steve talked about, we've got Azure Backup. And so one of the things is, like you talked about, we can back up our on-premises VMs. We can take that backup and store it in the cloud. So I can still keep my stuff on-prem and run it, but have my backup stored somewhere in the cloud. If I'm running Data Protection Manager, I can actually use Azure Backup as a target for Data Protection Manager, so I can have my kind of on-prem short-term stuff stored in Data Protection Manager on local disk, but my long-term stuff, that can get pushed up to Azure as well, into Azure Backup. So you know, and that would replace my tape. But the other thing that's kind of been is actually probably one of the biggest pains in the neck for running infrastructure as a service on any cloud service is backup of those VMs running on that cloud service. It's been pretty tricky up till now. And so one of the things we've got in Azure is we've actually got a managed backup service for infrastructure as a service VMs. So what I've got here is I've got Azure uses this concept of vaults, Azure backup uses. So I've got a backup vault set up here, and you'll see it set up here in Australia East. And so I'll click into that there. And if I scroll down the dashboard, you'll actually see I've got the option to protect Azure virtual machines. If I take this, it'll take me through a nice little wizard thing. And so you can see here, I've already got a couple of virtual machines discovered and registered. So discovery is basically, I click the button and it goes off and figures out what VMs I've got running in my subscription in that region. So you've got to have a vault in the same region that you're backing up this this stuff to. Once I've done my discovery and figured out what my VMs are and it's finished, that's fine, I can actually register those VMs into the vault. And so you know, you can see I've got the demo, you know, I've got my Ubuntu image that I was using before for my backups. I want to protect that, so I'll register that into, and that'll take a couple of seconds to register. And so I register the VMs into the vault. So there you go, you see it's popped up, or it's popping up as registering. Once it's registered, I then want to protect it. And so I've already got one machine being protected, so the last one left to protect is this database machine. So I can just run through this wizard, and I can either use an existing policy, or I can create a new policy, which, you know, demo 01. I can say when I want my backup to happen, you know, it happens daily at 12 p.m., but, you know, I might want it to happen at 10 p.m. So, okay, yep, cool. And then I'll get into my retention. So how long do I want to retain this stuff? So you can see there we've got standard grandfather, father, son style retention. And you'll see here, you know, we've got pretty long default retentions if you want to, but you can adjust all those. You know, I want to keep those for 8 days. Weeklies, I want to keep for 5 weeks. Monthlies, I only really care about them for, you know, 36 months or something. And then my yearlies, I'm pretty sure I can go up to 99 years. So I'll go yes, and away I go. And so now I'll back that stuff up, and now I've got a backup of that machine for 99 years, which is kind of handy.
If you don't believe us, you should try it. Yeah. In 99 years, yeah, we're going to prove it to you that we're all right.
That's right, yeah. Come back and see us. Yeah. And so it's as easy as that. I've got machines, I discover them, I register them, and then I protect them. And I protect them using a policy that I can be pretty flexible about. So, like I say, super easy, and that's a managed service inside Azure. So you're paying for storage and you're paying for the service itself. So instead of having to spin, you know, and what we've seen customers do is they spin up, you know, big VMs with lots of storage attached to them, and they've run DPM on them, or they run Commvault on them, or whatever they've run on them to back up all these things. Or they've done really unnatural things, like try and back them up to their on-premises backup server across the internet and things like that. And believe me, that doesn't end well. It certainly doesn't end with having a machine that you can recover anything from. So this is a really nice way to still kind of keep doing that backup and recover it. So I've actually got this. The other thing is, how do I recover it? Good question, because you know, that's kind of important. If I come down here to the VM itself and I just go restore, I can either, it'll either just pick up the newest recovery point for me, or I can say, well, I actually want to recover from you know, last month, the 29th, but it'll spin up a new virtual machine for me in a new cloud service, and so it'll protect that stuff for me now. It'll back restore that stuff up for me, and I can pull out my files and recover it back, or I can just switch over and do whatever I need to do to bring my service back online. So real easy, again, super easy to restore a VM, and you know, that'll take, you know, however long it takes to recover, not super long. So like I say, pretty easy. A couple of things to be aware of. At the moment, this service only works for VMs running in standard storage. It doesn't work for VMs running on premium storage. Again, that's kind of on the plan, but no fixed time frame to kind of talk about yet. Yeah, that's kind of the big thing, I guess, is premium storage. And yeah, so but like I say, super easy, and it is really, really handy to get around those scenarios where I'm building giant VMs running my backup software. I guess the other thing is that they currently don't support machines deployed using Azure Resource Manager. Again, on the roadmap, shouldn't be too far off either. So that's Azure Backup. Regan and Ben are talking about Azure Backup in depth on Friday, M375, if anyone's interested in going to that.
Okay, so a quick question, and I'm not really looking for a wordy answer. Do Microsoft care what hypervisor you're using to use Azure Site Recovery?
No.
Thank you very much. Make your way up and get a prize. So I think the gentleman over there was first, so you got first choice out of the umbrella or the power pack, but everyone else, we've got I think there's a couple of gifts left. So look, I just thought we'd finish off just talking about some of the related sessions that we think might be interesting for you. So the network sessions, Stu touched on that. So that's tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock if you're up. Azure Active Directory, so I think that's Rory Braybrook covers Azure Active Directory. I always find that really interesting. It's all, from my view, all roads lead to identity, and so I suggest you go along to that session. There's a guy from VFIX is talking about Azure Site Recovery, and particularly looking at VMware. And we've touched on OMS a couple of times, and so you'll hear how Massey are using the Operational Management Suite. So just a few sessions that we think would be of interest to you, given that you're at this one. And that's it, I suppose.
Filling your evals.
Okay.